A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Ram, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on February 23, 1992, in the series Jesus' Way, entitled His Way of Freedom with Religious Tradition. The scripture reading is Mark 2, verse 18 through chapter 3, verse 6. The text for the sermon is Mark 2, verse 22. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Mark painted a portrait of Jesus, not a snapshot, as though he kept a camera on him so that what he recorded is the way his days went from 9 in the morning until 9 at night, but a painting, a portrait. He gathered things together and grouped them, all in order to create for us the impression of Jesus, who this one was. And Mark, along with Matthew and Luke and John, took their hands at creating this person, various nuances. And for these weeks, as we move toward Lent, I promised you that I would give up preaching for Lent so that we could just listen to those Gospels together and allow the questions to arise, because this Jesus is a stranger and his voice is an alien voice. We must be honest. We have domesticated Jesus. We have tamed him. We have made him manageable. And sometimes it is important, I think, to recognize that he stands over against us as the stranger. He struggled to find his way. And he found his way in terms of that mission of announcing the nearness of God, the God of grace. And we saw last week that he immediately ran afoul of the established religious authorities of the church, because his conception of God as gracious and as inclusive was threatening and unpleasant for the church to hear. He drew the parameters of God's grace too broad, and he included those that the church had excluded. And the church does not take that lightly. He identified with Zacchaeus and said, "Zacchaeus, come down. I'm going to your house." And they were appalled that he would identify with one like Zacchaeus. And Zacchaeus brought him into his home, and there was joy in that home. If I had started the gospel lesson in Mark just a little earlier this morning, you would have found him calling another tax collector. He seemed to like tax collectors. This one's name was Levi. We know him as Matthew. Matthew was at his little toll booth. And Jesus said, "Matthew, or Levi, follow me." And Levi packed up his personal computer and followed him. And he threw him a party. It's interesting. Jesus liked tax collectors. I'm beginning to wonder whether or not he just didn't like to call those people who had the means to throw him a big party. He liked parties, I think. Just stop to think about it a moment. Zacchaeus certainly spread a good board. And Matthew invited all his friends. Mark tells us many bad characters were there. Well, you can have a good party with bad characters. So different than John the Baptist. And, of course, the Gospels tell us that, he said, you know, you can't win, folks. He said, John the Baptist, he was condemned for being so straight. He neither ate nor drank. And you say of me that I'm a wine bibber and a glutton. You can't win. And if you can't win, you might as well have a party. So, here he is, calling Levi, and that is offensive. And then Mark, as he's painting his portrait, now he gathers some stories. They didn't all happen boom, 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 boom like this, but Mark sort of went through the stuff of the tradition, and he puts here together a number of incidents, and biblical scholars call them conflict stories. Conflict stories. Because he's writing this portrait in order to understand who this person is, and this person, who was a good person, was done in by equally good people. And Mark, post-Easter, looking back on all of that, now in the context of the Christian movement, had to explain how this good person could have ended up crucified. And so he begins to build the story. He begins to paint the portrait. Gathers these conflict stories. Calling the wrong kind of people, Levi, as I just mentioned. And then one day there must have been some kind of a fast, a religious fast that was observed by those who were scrupulous in keeping religious observances. Jesus didn't keep it, nor his disciples. And so they came to him and they said, why? John's followers keep it. The Pharisees' disciples keep the fast, but you and your disciples don't keep the fast. He was running counter to a certain religious tradition or practice. He said, hey, you don't fast in the middle of a wedding reception. The bridegroom is here. It's a time for singing and dancing. How can we fast? Well, being traditional religionists, like I guess we are as well, they probably would have come back and said, look, stop the party and do your religious thing. And Jesus said, that's ridiculous. There's a place for fasting, of course. But if you're in the middle of a celebration that is good, if you're having a great party, then for goodness sakes, don't stop because divine worship has just begun. How many times have I heard about wonderful family celebrations that got interrupted because the evening service was coming? That's why we stopped having the evening service. It was hard on the family. But that is the point. That's what Jesus is trying to say. Fasting has its place. There will be a time and a place for the enhancement of one's spiritual life. Fast, fast, fast. But not just to fast. not in the middle of a joyful celebration. And then he and the disciples were going through the cornfield, and again Mark is putting these conflict stories together. And the disciples picked some grain. They were hungry. This was legitimate to do according to the law in terms of picking some grain, but they did it on the Sabbath, and they rubbed the heads together, and that was harvesting and reaping and threshing according to the very strict rules that overlaid the Sabbath. And again they said to him, look what your disciples are doing. It's not lawful to do on the Sabbath. He said, what's not lawful to do on the Sabbath? To meet bodily needs? To take care of legitimate human concerns? What do you think the Sabbath is anyway? And of course, the Sabbath was right at the heart of Jewish observance and Jewish religious life and worship. And probably no greater gift could Judaism give to the world than the observance of Sabbath. Sabbath, rest, a time to cease from labor, a time to cease from that compulsiveness, that drivenness that is so much a part of our lives. Stop, stop, let go, stop. Just stop. Consider creation. Worship God. Get your perspective back again. It's a great gift. But it can become such a burden, and it had become such a burden. Jesus said, look, it is for the well-being of humankind. It is God's gift to us. Not something that we, with legalistic, obligatory, grudging behavior, offer back to God. He said, you've got it turned on its head. I will not keep Sabbath the way you think Sabbath ought to be kept in order to please you. I will keep Sabbath according to the gracious purpose with which God instituted Sabbath. And then chapter 3 goes on with the story of Jesus in the synagogue and the person with the withered hand, the hostile feelings watching him. Jesus, understanding this, calling the man forward, saying, extend your hand, healing the man, and simply saying to them, look, is it right to do good or to do evil on the Sabbath? You would do more for an ox or an ass that falls into the ditch than for a fellow human being. And Mark tells us that Jesus was angry. That made him angry. Clergy types like me made him angry. You go through the Gospels, and there's a little anger here and there. Not so bad to be angry if it's for the right reason. And Jesus was angry. Never at fallible, vulnerable, weak, flawed people. Never at people who were sinning and strain and entangled in all of the ambiguity of life with its shadow side. No, he had nothing but grace for such people. He did. I mean, that's one of the reasons, as we've noted, that they killed him, because he could reach out and touch the leper. But clergy types, the guardians of the law and the tradition, they angered him. And he was grieved, Mark says, at their hardness of heart. It's such a shame And such a paradox, and so ironic. But, dear friends, there's no hardness of heart like the hardness of heart of God's people. I know that the fraternity and frivolity of the local tavern can be condemned. But sometimes there's a lot more milk of human kindness there. A lot more tolerance of human fallibility. A lot more honest community than we allow ourselves in the church. Part of our problem is that we get tied up with traditions. We have to take a look at traditions. Last week I said that religion has a certain legitimating function in society, and it does. Kind of puts a spiritual baptism over the structures of society, economic, political, social. Religion has always played that role. And part of the reason Jesus was crucified was because he challenged that arrangement of things. But another reason he was crucified was because he had a certain freedom over against religious traditions. So we just have to think for a moment about those traditions. And I want to say, religious traditions are good and necessary and proper. It's good to have certain ways to worship. It's good to have certain responses that we can go through without having to think about it. They become the track on which the locomotive runs. It's like driving a car. Wouldn't it be awful to drive a car and never get to the point where one could drive by second nature, sort of doing things involuntarily without having to think about it? Somebody stops in front of you, you don't go through the rational process of saying, those brake lights on the vehicle ahead of me just went on. That means that vehicle is going to stop. Therefore, I should stop sooner than better than later, probably. You don't have to do that. Lights go on, bingo. One time all through Germany, driving a little Volkswagen Bug, I kept crawling up on a bug ahead of me. All the time. Couldn't figure it out. Until I realized that bug didn't have any brake lights. And so he would slow down and I wouldn't know it. Next thing I knew is I was checking his carburetor. Thank you very much. Religious traditions are like that. They enable us to do things without having to stop to think. And because we can do things without having to stop to think, we can be freed to be lost in wonder, love, and praise. But those forms can never be set in concrete and absolutized and eternalized as though that is the only prescribed way in which we may worship. And the church needs to be organized. It needs to have a form of government. But right now in this congregation, there's a task force that's looking at the way we govern ourselves, because the way we govern ourselves presently worked wonderfully in the 17th century when it was constituted. But the way we govern ourselves according to the Constitution of the Reformed Church in America has, if the Constitution had measles, the way our life actually exists would never catch it. There's no relationship between the way we function as a congregation and the Constitution that says we should be governed this way. And so we have a task force that's looking at that, because the way the church governs itself isn't absolute or eternal or sacred. It's a practical matter. It's important to have a way, but you can never absolutize the way. And creedal statements too. The church wrote creeds because somebody said this, and the church as a whole said, no, not that, this. Creeds were always to define over against. Generally, in the face of something that the church didn't believe, it said, no, not that, we believe this. And there's nothing wrong with that. Absolutely necessary. Important. The only trouble is not that the church writes creeds, but that the church stopped writing creeds. Creed needs to be written about every decade. Certainly every generation. Traditions are necessary and positive and important unless they become identified with the thing in itself, which is the worship of God and the living communion of a person with God. And when the institutional forms, the traditions, become oppressive, then they need to be shattered so that people may be unshackled, so that people may again find that living communion with the God who is always before us. So traditions are fine, but they are always a peril, because God becomes identified with a certain way to worship or a certain creedal statement or a certain form of the church. And then we are worshiping the scaffolding, which is only there in order that the temple may be built. Tradition, Jesus said, it's kind of like new wine. You don't put new wine in brittle old goat skins, or the wine will ferment and it'll burst the skins and you'll lose the wine and you'll lose the skins. You see, Jesus wasn't an iconoclast in the sense of wanting to throw things away. Jesus was saying, look, folks, if you don't want to lose it, you better be willing to change it. Because life doesn't stand still. History is not some frozen stream, but an ever-moving drama. Now, they crucified Jesus. And I would like to have you think, as I close, about Jesus and us. I started out by saying that, you know, we domesticate Jesus and he's our Jesus. He's our friend. We like him. And he likes us. Seldom do we hear him as the stranger and the alien in our midst. We love to identify with Jesus over against those blind Pharisees and those compromising Sadducees, those legalistic scribes. We like to see him put them in their place. And we can even feel some of his anger That's right, Jesus. Tell them. Let them have it. Well, we don't face often enough is the fact that if he came today, he'd have a thing or two to say to us that would be quite as unsettling as the things he had to say to them. Our ways that have become comfortable and familiar and have arisen positively, spontaneously in the past in order to enable those ways that perhaps have lost their compelling power, those ways that we keep in place, now no longer vehicles, but now idols, now no longer liberating, but binding. Jesus would have something to say to us. I feel so certain, dear friends. It was just good, honest, sincere people like us that killed him. It's tough, though. It's not easy. It's not simple. I mean, he could come on as this itinerant rabbi challenging the whole institution and all of the establishment. But you see, that rebel movement in his name has become the Christian church. It has become what we are. Now we are the dominant consciousness. Now we are the compelling power. And we're all entangled in the nation that is number one. We are all part of Western culture. We are all slotted in there. He would probably call us to walk a road and adopt a style that would be just as disruptive, just as unsettling, just as chaotic as that with which he confronted Caiaphas and Annas and the whole temple crowd. Now, I want to say this too. He'd let us have it, and then he'd love us. He would challenge us. He'd put his arms around us. He'd be gracious to us, patient with us. But he might say to us, for God's sake, and for the freedom of your own soul, open up. Follow me. Follow me. I wonder what it means today. I really wonder, honestly wonder, before you, in your presence, with you, what it means today. I'm not here with a ready-made answer. I'm not even sure. I want to look the answer square in the face. But I'm tired of skirting the question.